Well, welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is Thursday, March 5th. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted that you could join me this evening and that you could mute out. Tonight, we're going to just talk briefly about the top stories in money and markets. I'm going to defer the green tech questions for really what's going to be a very exciting discussion with John Rubino about green tech investing. And then we still continue to get a lot of questions about precious metals, which I'm going to defer to next week when we do our precious metals update with Franklin Sanders. Our discussion tonight is going to be followed by my comments on George Baker's documentary, The Endurance. Hopefully you've had a chance to see it. But don't worry if you hadn't. The comments will still be useful, and you can always see it the next week. If somebody's just come in, we need you to hit
start
to mute out.
Mute.
Off for me.
Off for me.
I need to mute out.
Okay.
How do you mute out?
You hit *6 on your telephone.
Okay.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay, money and markets. At the top of the blog, we put up a little chart. It's under proposed U.S. budget, and it helps to put the stimulus package in context. What it shows is a little summary from the administration's proposed 2010 budget, and essentially what we're looking at is total revenues of $2.3 trillion, total tax revenues of $1 trillion, which is significantly down from say 5 or 6 years ago, and then it shows the total uses of money. We have $739 billion going to defense, $1.4 trillion going to bank bailout, $164 billion going to interest. So essentially, it tells a very simple and true story about the U.S. government. The U.S. government collects taxes from Americans and then sells debt globally that is essentially a taxation system through the balance sheet, and then turns around and gives the money to the banks and funds the military. If you just dialed in, could you hit *6? We need the audience to mute themselves out this time. *6. Anyway, so take a look at that little chart on the budget, and you'll get it will really put the stimulus package in context as to what the government finances at this point are all about. We're just now starting into March, and we're really beginning to see. Remember, I've said all along that March is the disclosure and tax dates, and that's when we're going to start hitting some real problems. European banks were in real trouble last week. Rumors were that they sold significant amounts of gold. This week we saw the price of precious metals falling. It has real strength and came back today with more drops in the stock market. We saw Citibank stock drop under $1 and JP Morgan stock down to $16. All sorts of negative news about GE and the derivatives book, both at GE and JP Morgan. It's really important if you look at a long-term chart on both of these stocks. We've been here before. Sort of the last pump and dump, the housing bubble bust in 1990-91, we saw Citibank down at $1 and J.P. Morgan down at $3, so we've been there before. Bill Murphy at Le Metropole Café, the chairman of GATA, calls it the race to zero or the race to the bottom. But it's really happening, and inside of that, what you're hearing is tremendous jawboning of the economy down. And I want to tell a story because the most important thing I want you to get from this little money and markets discussion tonight is a real clear picture that you're not going to be tricked by these guys' negativity. Because when we were in the middle of the boom, you used to hear Greenspan and Rubin and all these guys say that everything was terrific. And, you know, they were lying then, and now when they say it's absolutely terrible, they're lying now. And I want to talk a little bit about that. In the 1990s, when I was living in Washington running Hamilton Securities, I I had hired, we were doing a lot of very sophisticated technology and software development. And I hired, we had a whole bunch of young technologists, PhDs from MIT. And we also had a lot of much older real estate and investment bankers. And literally, we had a war break out between the two groups. And I was really, really challenged about how I was going to manage the integration of the real estate and investment banking worlds with the technology and software world. And I finally, someone gave me a wonderful speech. It was on an audio by an anthropologist named Jennifer James. And in the, if you just dialed in, if you could, we need the audience to hit star six and mute out tonight. Thank you very much. So they gave me the speech by Jennifer James, and in the speech, Jennifer James describes the fact that if you survey the sort of senior CEO executive in the American workforce and you ask him who his mythological hero is, you'll find out that it's the Lone Ranger. And if you do a similar survey for his son or grandson in the workforce, in fact, their mythological hero is the Ninja Turtle. And in fact, if you've ever seen the Ninja Turtles, and if you remember the Lone Ranger, what you're looking at is two very fundamental mythologies of what success is and how to succeed. The Lone Ranger rides into town by himself, you know, doesn't tell anybody anything, saves the whole situation, and then when it's over, everybody says, oh, thank you, masked man. The Ninja Turtles are the exact opposite. They do everything together. They share everything. They have, you know, Italian Renaissance names, and they share credit with everybody. And it's literally the two cultures, the sort of win-lose culture of the baby boomer generation or the older baby boomer generations versus the sort of collaborative economy of information technology. And literally that speech saved my life because what I discovered was you couldn't have both cultures succeed. You had to let one be dominant. And ultimately we let the Ninja Turtles be dominant because the Ninja Turtles love to share. And one of the things I found was I had two kinds of Lone Rangers. One Lone Ranger would basically, you know, want to go save everybody. They'd work really hard. They'd pull it off by themselves. They'd do a really good job. They weren't much of a team player, but they were very high performance. I had a tremendous amount of other Lone Rangers who finally, what I discovered is the way that they could fix everything was they would break it first. They would sneak around, they would break it, they would create a crisis, and then they would demand that I needed them to fix it. Now, why do I tell you the story of the Lone Ranger and the Ninja Turtles? Today in the Wall Street Journal, there was a huge page ad on page A13. It's advertising an event they're having in Washington called The Future of Finance, March 23rd, 24th, Finance in Crisis. Here's what it says. The world's financial system has broken down. First of all, that's not true. The world's financial system is operating for the first time in 10 years because everyone knows not to trust parties who are untrustworthy, and everybody realizes that a debt bubble is a bad thing. And so, in fact, the breaking down that we're seeing is very healthy because capital does not want to continue to flow to things that are unproductive. Credit remains constrained. Well, that means credit isn't flowing to the unproductive fraudsters. Markets and regulatory regimes have failed. No, they haven't failed. They haven't been used. If anything, we've seen government taken over and misused. At this critical, if you just dialed in, if you could hit star six, we need the audience to mute out. Thank you. If you just dialed in, if you could hit star six, I would appreciate it. Thank you so much. At this critical moment, the editors of the Wall Street Journal are convening the leading experts and practitioners. If everyone could hit star six and mute themselves out, that would be terrific. If you could hit star six and mute out, that'd be terrific. Oh, she tells you to trust me.
No, I had them together all the time before. No, remember I had them on all. I had three phones on all the time. All the other conferences we've ever had. Right at the, all of them are on the table.
Yeah.
Somebody's
They're
speaking.
They're literally right here on the table.
Hello. Hello.
Catherine, I think I know who that is. It's Eliana, and I will call them on their other line and ask
Okay,
them
thank
that.
You.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm so sorry about this. Okay, at this critical moment, the editors of the Wall Street Journal are convening leading experts and practitioners in global finance for a working session to identify the basic principles on which the financial system must be reconstructed. That's not true either. If you look at the people on the list, we've got Bob Rubin, who was we've essentially got all the people who created the problem in the first place. We've got a partner at Sullivan and Cromwell. We've got folks from the Carlyle Group. We've got Bob Rubin. We've got George Soros, who's on TV saying that the system has collapsed. So the reality is, when these guys tell you the system is broken and we need them to fix it, it's just not true. We need them to be gone. And in fact, I put up recently a wonderful video of the author of a book that's gotten a lot of attention called The Black Swan. I can't believe he got on TV, but the talking heads were interviewing him. He said, look, if you leave the same people in charge who caused the problem in the first place, there are no solutions. So these are the guys who brought us to where we are. Don't listen to them. Don't believe them. And they certainly aren't the solution. And the reality is, we're dealing in a situation where it's Naomi Klein wrote a wonderful book describing it, where we're the target of shock and awe. And I'm not saying that things aren't difficult and we don't need to change, but the first thing we need to do is not listen to these guys. We need to not fall prey to the shock and awe and the fear that comes with it. So that's it for money and markets. The spin is a lie, and it's really important to keep yourself focused on what's real and how we shift capital out of what's unreal into what's real. So with that in mind, I want to introduce, it's really a pleasure to introduce John Rubino. I first met John when he co-authored a book with James Turk, The Collapse of the Dollar and How to Profit from It, which is, if you haven't read it, is one of the best introductions to the whole area of precious metal investing and sort of sound money and what's been really happening in the economy, sort of the long, deep trends, and the whole shift from financial assets to tangible assets. And it's remarkable. And so when I heard that John had written a book about the green tech phenomena and his latest book, Clean Money, Picking Winners in the Green Tech Boom, I was thrilled because John is such a clear thinker and clear writer. I put his resume up on the web, so I won't. If you're dialed in, if you could please hit *6 and mute out, I would really appreciate it. If you could hit *6 and mute out, that would be great. Well, I'm just gonna have to focus. If you could hit *6 and just mute out. Okay, so John's background is in investing is significant. I won't repeat it here. He's currently writing for CFA Magazine and edits dollarcollapse.com and greenstockinvesting.com. I spent quite a while trying to sort of sort through this area several years ago, and finally, because of the complexity, just felt overwhelmed and was delighted to read John's book. He gives a great framework. We're gonna walk through it tonight. I just want to point out one thing because I thought, you know, it's not going to surprise me to get the question with the equity market sliding down, down, down. Why would you want to talk about investing in green technology? And the reason is a story you've heard me tell before, which is Franklin Sanders once said to me, he said, you know, what I like to impress upon people who've been contemplating financial meltdown and Armageddon for far too long is the morning after the financial meltdown, somebody's going to wake up wanting breakfast, and somebody's going to make money cooking it for them. And the reality is, if you look at the algebra and the economics of our situation, when we cook that breakfast, we're going to need cheaper energy, and we're going to need that energy to have a lower environmental footprint than it does. So So if we're going to shift our capital out of the bubble and into safe havens, the time is coming at some point. The market will find its levels just like it did in 89 and 90. And we're going to have to grapple with, okay, how do we shift out of safe havens and into enterprises that are really going to bring real solutions and change things? My prediction is that this is going to be a very long-lived phenomena, and one in which there's going to be great wealth created. So this is an area that's worth taking the time to learn now, because it's something that's going to be important. It's going to be important for a long time. So with that lengthy introduction, John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. We may have to, again, I'd like to ask the audience to just all hit *6. If you could mute yourself out locally, we'd really appreciate it. Great. Thank you so much. Okay, John, I thought we'd run through the different areas, starting with clean energy.
Okay.
Okay. And our first step is we've got many different types. And, of course, one of the challenges of this area is if you're not an engineer or utility executive, it's a lot for someone like me to digest. But so let's start with solar.
Okay.
What is solar, and where – what's happening in the world of solar investment?
Okay, yeah. So solar is the highest profile clean technology, and it comes in two types. The first and the biggest is called photovoltaics, and that is basically a technology that turns sunlight into electricity. You put a semiconductor like silicon in bright light, and the photons will knock some electrons loose, and you can capture them as an electrical current. These are the rooftop panels that we see on houses and have seen for decades, really. But what's interesting now about photovoltaics is that it used to be too expensive to really be worth the trouble. The panels would cost more than you save by putting them up. But year after year, they've gotten a little bit cheaper and a little bit cheaper until they're at the point now where they're actually a pretty good deal. So you can, if you're in a sunny place like, let's say, Arizona, you can bolt some solar panels onto your roof and expect to get them paid off from what you save by not having to pay for electricity from the utility in a reasonable amount of time. And the cost declines are accelerating, so that they're getting cheaper and cheaper, and they're reaching the point that they call grid parity, which is where solar power is as cheap as what you would buy from the local utility. And at that point, the floodgates will open when
right.
anybody can put solar panels on their roof and actually make money from it, then we'll see massive demand all around the world. And we're just about at that point now where with the subsidies that a lot of governments offer, solar panels pay themselves off in a reasonable time.
How many states are offering? Is it state or federal?
That's all over the place. You know, a lot of different countries offer various incentives, and a lot of states offer their own. And the federal government in the new budget offers some kind of a subsidy. So it really depends on where you live, but there's usually some kind of a subsidy. Either they give you 30% of the cost of the system, or they force the utility to buy the electricity you generate at a good rate from you, or whatever. But most places subsidize solar power to some extent, and there's a fair bet that the subsidies will actually increase over time as governments come to the conclusion that this is the kind of power that, you know, is now a good deal and is now something they should be subsidizing.
I'm assuming all these stocks have gotten hammered along with the equity markets in general.
Oh yeah. Yeah, they've just gotten whacked for basically three reasons. One, stocks are down in general. Two, oil prices have plunged in the last year, which makes clean tech in general and alternative energy in particular less attractive by comparison, because suddenly we don't have this massive energy cost problem to deal with.
Right.
And the third is that in solar, two or three years ago, everybody was throwing money at solar power. And everybody who was in the business was able to attract enough money to build new factories and to grow. So everybody did. And so now we've got this massive glut of solar panels out there, which is a good thing in a way because it's causing costs to fall even more dramatically than they were, which makes solar a better deal for consumers. But it's making it harder and harder for the companies in the business to turn a profit.
And it's really funny that the economic warfare that you see in the commodities markets, and part of that is sort of geopolitics, is really wreaking havoc on companies trying to make a difference in this area.
Oh, yeah. But part of this, too, is just it's the normal business cycle in a hot field.
Right.
Semiconductors go through the same thing. Every 10 years, they build too many fabs, and there's a glut of chips, and chip prices fall, and the stocks go down. And then it all gets soaked up, and the prices go up, and the stocks go up. And so we're at the down cycle part for solar.
Okay, so wind.
Wind?
Wind is the next.
Okay. Yeah, wind is, that's the most familiar kind of clean technology, because we all know what windmills are. And but today's utility scale wind farms use windmills that are gigantic. You know, they're two or three football fields tall, and really, really wide and really powerful. And they generate enough power, each one of these things, for a small community.
Right.
And so you string a lot of them together in a windy place, and you get a lot of power, and you get it at a reasonable cost. Wind power, though, there are still questions about whether it really delivers everything the proponents say that it does. It seems to be cheap, clean power. And
has anybody figured out how to bring it down to a small scale like solar?
No.
No.
The nice thing about solar is that a solar panel on your roof is just as efficient as 10,000 of them in the desert. And so it's great for distributed power, which is a really attractive idea, because a grid that's powered by a million roofs with solar panels is much harder to disrupt than one that's powered by one big nuclear plant or whatever.
Right.
And so the distributed generation angle is in solar's favor and a really powerful selling point. But wind doesn't have that because it doesn't scale down. You know, a small windmill is not as efficient, so you don't get the cheap electricity that you get from a big windmill. So,
are the companies in this area, are they wind farms or are they making the turbines?
Both. The turbine makers are generally big companies. This is a utility-scale business across the board. Wind.
Uh-huh.
The turbine makers are big companies like Vestas, which is in Denmark, and GE and Siemens. And the companies that buy and build wind farms are generally utilities, which are also very big companies. And so there aren't a lot of hot little growth stocks. There are a few that supply components and things like
right.
that, and a few individual wind farm operators. But mostly these are big companies that have the characteristics of big companies. So not hot growth in this area, but steady growth. You know, 15-20% a year we'll see for until the rest of most of our lives probably
right.
in wind.
Okay, geothermal.
Okay, geothermal is... This is a very cool clean tech that has a big future, and it's based on the idea that the further you go down into the Earth's crust, the warmer it gets. So we're learning how to either tap the hot water that comes up from hot springs because of this, or drill down and create our own what they call geothermal reservoirs, which you can then use to run a turbine on the surface. And it turns out that huge sections of the world have heat reasonably close to the surface that we can tap and use to generate electricity. And this kind of power is very clean. It's very cheap. It competes with coal on price, even up without subsidies, which is very unusual in the clean tech space. And it runs 24/7. You know, with solar and wind, they operate when the sun is shining or when the wind is blowing, and they don't when it isn't. With geothermal, 24/7. So this is baseline
power. Wow, that's an amazing
power.
Advantage.
Yeah, it's a huge advantage, and it's very clean. You can put a geothermal plant in the middle of a town or of an orchard or whatever, and it doesn't disrupt anything. So the geothermal business is kind of like gold mining right now. There's a lot of people out there looking for resources. They're prospecting. And when they find something that's it's really promising. They raise the money to set up the plant, and then they cut a deal with the local utility and sell the power to it. And because of that, you've got a wide range of businesses in this field. You've got the equivalent of junior gold miners out there looking for...
John, let me just interrupt. If you're in the audience and you've just dialed in, if you could hit star 6 to mute out. We've got somebody who's not muted out. Oh, great. Thank you so much. John, go ahead.
Okay. That's basically geothermal story. There's a next generation of geothermal technology that's coming along called enhanced geothermal that allows you basically to drill anywhere using technologies that were developed in the oil industry for drilling deep. You drill a deep hole, drill another deep hole, pump water through the one hole, and then capture the hot water that bubbles up through the other hole. And use that to run a turbine. So if that works, we're going to be able basically to set up geothermal plants anywhere.
I was in Anchorage when the folks from Iceland were coming to talk with the Anchorage about licensing their technology, and it was astonishing what the possibilities were, and the the drops in cost to all of Anchorage would be phenomenal.
Yeah. Iceland, because they sit on a lot of hot springs, figured out how to tap that and use it for power. And so they get most of their electricity a large part of their electricity from geothermal. And they take that water and they pump it under the sidewalks, so their sidewalks are clear all year long. And all their swimming pools are heated. And so you can go swimming there all year round because the water's always warm. So it sounds nice. A lot of cities have that kind of potential. So we'll see them tapping that potential in the future as people look at Iceland and say, hey, I want to do it that way too.
Transportation and what you call green machines.
Yeah. We're on the verge of the age of plug-in hybrids, basically, which are cars that have big batteries and are run with electric motors. And then the batteries charge overnight. You plug them in, they charge, and then you get maybe 40 to 100 miles of driving from a single charge. And if your commute is less than that, you use no gas. So you're basically operating an electric car. And they have small gas engines on board that can, when you go beyond the limit of the batteries, can help recharge the batteries or take over some of the driving. But the idea is very attractive. And
what would the cost of such a car be?
Well, right now, traditional hybrids, which mostly run on a gas engine with an electric engine or electric motor to help, are a few thousand dollars more than a normal internal combustion configuration of a car. And it's reasonable to think that plug-in hybrids will be similar. They'll be a little bit more expensive, but too much more. And the difference between electricity, which is reasonably cheap, and gasoline, which, who knows, but in the future might be more expensive, will be big enough to pay off the car, the difference in the price of the car. And so when we get to that point, a lot of really interesting things become possible. For instance, let's say you charge your car overnight, drive it to work, park it in a parking lot, and there you have this battery, this source of power that's just sitting there. So there will be parking lots where people plug in their cars, and then the utility draws on that power during the day, which is peak energy demand, and pays you peak rates for it. And in that way, doesn't have to build a lot of new power plants. So you win, the utility wins.
Do they give you back enough so you can drive home?
Yeah, they leave you enough so you can get home.
Okay.
And so you work that out ahead of time, how much you're going to need. But they call that vehicle to grid, V2G. And if it works, it'll smooth out the fluctuations in power demand.
When do you have a sense, John, when this is coming?
Plug-in hybrids are close. The key to them working is new battery technology. And so this would be a good time to talk about batteries because they're
okay.
The key to so much in clean tech. But basically, we need better batteries than we have today in order to carry enough power around to take a car 40 miles or 60 miles or whatever. But they're coming. There's one technology called lithium ion, which was developed originally for laptop batteries and cell phones and things like that. And they're scaling that up and making it safer and more powerful, and it looks like it might work in the next couple of years. And there's another concept called the ultracapacitor, which looks like either on its own or in combination with lithium-ion batteries might also work. So most of the big car companies have plug-in hybrids in the pipeline for a year or two from now.
And the energy storage, could it be used for, what are the applications?
Oh, you mean beyond plug-in hybrids?
Beyond cars.
Oh, yeah. Well, solar farms and wind farms both produce electricity only sporadically, but they produce a lot when they do. So for them to be viable, large-scale sources of electricity for us, we have to find a way to store the excess power that they produce.
Ah, so that could make solar or wind much more usable.
Oh, yeah. Because that would basically convert solar and wind into baseline power, something that can run 24/7. And there are five or six new large-scale battery configurations that are coming to market now that all look promising. You know, none of them have proven themselves yet, but all we need is one.
Right.
And
exactly.
When it works, then that changes everything. So batteries are crucial, and huge amounts of money are flowing into batteries now, and breakthroughs are coming out daily. It's fascinating to watch that field, and I think there's a really high probability that the next generation of battery tech will work adequately for a lot of the uses that we now don't have adequate batteries for. And
is it startup companies or is it large existing companies that are doing the storage?
Both. A lot of companies make lithium-ion batteries for the laptop market, and they're moving over into plug-in hybrids and other things. And then there's a lot of startups that have radical new designs that they're bringing to market. And they're not really investable from the point of view of an individual yet because they're pretty risky. But at some point, one or two of them might succeed, and then they'll be huge. You know, if they patented some new breakthrough and there's this gigantic market for it, they'll be interesting growth stocks at the time.
Okay, well, something near and dear to my heart is biofuels.
Yeah. Biofuels are based on the idea that plants are basically energy storage devices. You know, they eat sunlight and carbon dioxide and turn it into leaves and stems, and we can turn that into energy if we can figure out a way to do it on a utility scale and cheaply enough. And so we've been trying. You know, the first generation of biofuels was based on corn because we know how to grow corn and we know how to turn it into ethanol, and so it seemed like a reasonable place to start. But it turned out that turning food into fuel has a lot of problems, and that corn really isn't the most efficient way to do it anyhow, because it takes a lot of energy in order to produce the energy, and so you don't get much of a net gain. But there are other kinds of biofuels on the horizon that look like they might be a lot better. A couple of plants, Jatropha and switchgrass, look like they produce more power per acre than corn does, and they do it by growing on grass or on land that isn't necessarily good for farming anyhow. So it's marginal land that we aren't now using, and so they've got potential. And then a little further along is algae, single-celled organisms that grow in the ocean normally that produce massive amounts of oil that can be turned into biofuel.
Right. We were talking today, a subscriber sent me a video of a company that's doing algae. I think it's in New Mexico, and it just, my jaw was on the floor. It was astonishing what they were describing.
Yeah. The yields on algae biofuel plants are just huge. You know, and if this works, that's a good solution, because this does not take farmland. You grow them in vats. And,
right.
So it'll work. But algae is kind of finicky. You know, if you don't have the conditions just right, it can all die, and then you've lost your crop, and then you have nothing. So we don't really know how to do algae biofuel on a commercial scale yet, but it's possible that we'll figure it out in the next couple of years, and then that'll be a huge breakthrough when it happens. So,
This particular video said it was 22,000% more efficient than corn.
Yeah, okay. one thing I just picked off the internet here was that algae can produce more oil in an area the size of a two-car garage than a football field of soybeans. So, the stats are pretty impressive. So I think biofuels, from an investor standpoint, is a couple of years away. There's nothing really that's compelling right now. But a few years from now, we should have all kinds of growth stocks to pick from.
The one thing I will say about, because I'm working with local farmers in ethanol, and we had an ethanol team over in the Financial Permaculture Summit, where you've got an operation that's using 100% of the byproducts very efficiently, and what it does is it simply, and you end up paying yourself, and it's economic compared to what you'd be doing otherwise. Very small-scale biofuels makes a lot of sense. So,
good.
But it's not, that's not going to generate a stock in the stock market.
No, unless you network.
Or unless you trade places, which is a whole other conversation.
Yeah. Biofuels, it has a really interesting future because there are so many different niches.
Right.
In which it can work, you could make a career out of just specializing in analyzing biofuels and investing in them, but not yet.
Okay, well, we'll save us from that. So let's go to hydrogen.
Yeah, hydrogen is one of those things that's been the next big thing for decades now. Basically, it's this ubiquitous substance that can be burned very cleanly and can run a fuel cell, which is kind of an engine, where the only byproduct is water. So a car that's powered by a fuel cell is completely non-polluting. It's quiet. Theoretically, it gets really good mileage. And so the idea is really attractive. But we haven't been able to figure out how to make hydrogen cheaply enough to make switching over from fossil fuels to hydrogen economy-wide worth it. And here again, there are a lot of new technologies on the horizon for making hydrogen more cheaply and for making fuel cells operate more cheaply. So one of these days it might work. Right now it doesn't seem to, on any kind of a scale, for something like transportation. So there are niches where fuel cells work. But it's not a large-scale growth stock kind of thing yet. So that's another one that you want to file away. Pay attention to it and come back every year or two and see what's up. And at some point, it'll be big.
And smart grid.
Yeah. Now smart grid is something that's here now and going to be very, very big. Basically, the idea is that the electrical grid it does not have much intelligence in it right now. A utility just pumps out as much electricity as its customers seem to need, and then when it can't pump out anymore, it goes down, and we have brownouts or blackouts. And consumers use as much electricity as we feel like we need without knowing how much we're spending at any given time or which appliance is costing us what. And so by applying information technology to the grid, we solve that problem. And 10 years from now, in your house, you'll have a wall screen that shows you which room and which appliance within it, which room, is using how much electricity at a given time and costing you whatever. And presumably that'll be a big behavior change thing. When you see that the plasma TV is costing you a lot right now, you'll turn it off. When you leave a room, you'll turn out the light. And utilities will be able to see who's doing what and be able to reach out to their customers' homes and businesses and selectively turn off appliances when the demand for power gets beyond whatever the utilities.
They can do it even if we don't want them to do it?
Well, you would agree to the utility being able to do that for short periods of time, like turn your refrigerator off for 5 minutes.
Right.
You wouldn't even know that it was happening, but they would pay you for that right so that when they needed to reach out and lessen the peak power demand, they'd be able to do it. And so that, 5 minutes on your refrigerator doesn't save much, but multiply that by 1 million homes, And you
it's tremendous.
Save, yeah, you save the equivalent of a big gas-fired plant. And then utilities will also be able to reach out and draw on the backup power supplies of all the businesses in their territory. So anyhow, you put all this together and you've got a system that's smart and flexible and won't go down and won't need nearly as much reserve capacity, and so it will be a lot cheaper. And all these technologies exist right now. There are companies out there that make smart meters and can put together networks of backup power plants and connect them to the utility. And there are lots of interesting growth stocks in this field, and a lot of them are going to get a lot bigger going forward.
And it's now.
It's
they
now.
Can do this now.
This stuff is here. Yeah, it doesn't require any breakthroughs. There's going to be a lot of progress, but just given what we can do now. You know, see, the Internet blazed this trail. All the interactivity in the Internet that we've developed can just be applied to the utility grid.
Now, one of the things you talked about in your book was utilities that are playing a leading role, and that kind of jumped out at me because you always have some people who really need reliable yield, and, of course, utilities is the old standby. And if we've got utilities that are really leading in this area, then that would be very attractive for a certain segment of investor.
Yeah, some utilities get this and some don't. So the ones that get it have been building wind farms and paying their customers to install solar panels on their rooftops and doing lots of other things like that, or setting up smart cities where they install smart grid equipment across whole neighborhoods or whole cities, and they will probably be the utilities that do relatively well going forward in a world where carbon is getting a lot more expensive and we're being paid one way or another to go green. So those would be the utilities that you would want to own, and they would be a lot less risky because they wouldn't be subject to spikes in coal prices or oil prices or geopolitical this or that.
Right.
And in Clean Money, I publish a list of utilities that score well on a lot of green scales that seem to be doing the best right now. And a portfolio of those utilities would pay you a reasonable dividend. They'd be pretty safe. And yet they would have a pretty good chance of growing going forward and increasing their dividends. So you would have a chance to have some capital gains and an increase in your income stream in the future.
Okay, now one of the things I wanted to ask you is, given what you know, because you're following a lot of the products and services that are being developed, what are the things we should try in our lives? I'm a great believer before I invest in something and wanting to try it personally. So where are the opportunities for us to just try some things?
Well, there are a few out there. I mean, if you're in a sunny place, rooftop solar panels are something that you can install right now. In fact, there are a lot of installers out there that will basically put the panels up for free in return for a cut of your savings because your utility bills will go down. So,
wow, that's attractive.
Yeah, isn't that cool? And that's being done in a lot of the southwestern U.S. right now. So you just want to call around and find out if anybody offers a deal like that and then just have them do it. Another thing that's really interesting is the geothermal heat pump. Basically, you bury pipes in your backyard and liquid circulates through the pipes and then takes advantage of the differential between the air and the 6 feet under the ground where it's always a stable temperature and uses that to heat or cool your house. And that's something that's completely non-polluting and quiet and reasonably cheap. And basically, it cuts your utility bills dramatically while not using any fossil fuels. So if you're building a new house, you can have that geothermal heat pump installed as part of the construction process while you've got the earth movers out there.
And the smart grid, it sounds like we can do now.
You can do some smart grid stuff, yeah. There are meters that you can buy and install which basically tell you how much electricity you're using in real time. They're not as detailed as, room by room, appliance by appliance yet, but
right.
You can still see the meter running. And that alone is, I think, kind of interesting because then you'll be able to know what it's costing you in real time to do whatever it is you're doing, and presumably there are things you can do better. And soon we'll be able to buy a plug-in hybrid. That's coming. And within another year, maybe there should be some on the market.
Now you told me a new world word today that I want everybody to hear: negawatts.
Yeah. Okay. Megawatts is a smart grid concept that it's a play on megawatts, but it's negative watts. In other words, if you upgrade the electrical grid so that you save power. In other words, you don't need to build this big power plant here anymore because we're operating so much more efficiently. Then instead of building the capacity to produce megawatts, you're building the capacity to produce negawatts. And that's actually the cheapest form of electricity that's out there right now. You know, saving it by making the grid smarter is cheaper than building wind farms or solar farms,
right,
or basically anything else. So it's a great deal. And it's just another reason why smart grid is going to be such a hot investment concept.
Okay, we've got somebody who needs to mute out by hitting *6. Who's doing that? Can the person who has not muted themselves out mute out *6? I know, John, I think we're just going to talk over it.
Okay. Yeah, I just hear some static.
Yeah. Now, let's just talk a little bit about the risk questions, because I know I've always been very concerned about the fraud that could take place in this area.
Well, hot markets...
You're going to have to talk really loud, John, over the
okay.
static.
it's a general rule of thumb investing. The hotter the market is, the riskier it is, because something like the Internet or now clean tech, when very attractive to a lot of people, it attracts, first of all, a lot of delusionals and then con artists and people with spectacularly disruptive sounding ideas that might or might not work. And it's easy to get sucked into the story. And there will be hundreds of clean tech companies.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, it's what we saw during the Internet boom.
Yes. Exactly. So how do you tell the difference between pets.com?
You're going to have to talk even louder.
Okay. They all sound great when everything is moving. And so we have to come up with tools to separate the wheat from the chaff, the stories with legs from the ones that are going to just come and go. And that's tricky in a field where the technologies aren't that well understood. So.
Right.
The main thing that you want to do is just don't get sucked into story stuff. If something is brand new and it doesn't have sales or earnings yet, but it sounds fantastic, pass on it. Wait till it generates real orders from real companies and is actually generating cash flow. And you're going to miss the early pop, but you'll
right.
also avoid the risk that it just ceases to exist and you lose all your money. So that's
right.
the single most important
another thing that worries me, particularly because some of this technology, you know, there's been technology that's really been kept off the markets, including by dirty tricks. I mean, the stories abound, but you're going to have, you know, technologies coming out and looking great, and then a new technology come out and replace it. It's what I call creative destruction, and that can be very expensive if you're an investor in the first company.
Oh yeah, and that's happening today because for every incumbent technology out there, there are 20 ideas percolating in labs right now that would seriously affect the competitive place of the incumbent technologies. So that's going to happen, and the one thing that makes it not quite as serious as it could be is that it takes a really long time to go from lab to market. So
right.
the technologies that are now leading, they'll have some time in which to make some money. So they won't just be destroyed overnight, but still, there's always the risk that something comes along that's radically better than whatever it is you're investing in. You have to pay attention to that. So one way to do that is just to keep track of the breakthroughs that are happening out there. And there are websites that track that. I track some of it on Green.
I'd rather read your website than track it myself.
Well,
okay, so let's go through the other areas quickly. We've got green building, which, of course, is very close to my heart.
Yeah.
Tell us what's happening in green building.
Well, the idea behind green building is that previously most of our houses and office buildings weren't put up with the idea of energy efficiency or even really livability. And now we're finding out that that those things have value. You can arrange the windows in such a way that the inside of the building is lit most of the day with natural light, or you can use light pipes which bring light from the roof down to the inside of a building, and you can set up smart internal systems that know when somebody's in a room and turn on the lights and then turn off the lights when they leave and adjust the air flows. And in commercial buildings, you can have cogeneration systems that use waste heat to heat the building and make them a lot more efficient. So you add it all up, and new buildings can be a lot more energy efficient and a lot more pleasant to live in than old buildings. And so basically every building that's going to be put up from now on in the developed countries, and to an extent in the developing countries, is going to incorporate these smart grid, green building technologies. And the companies that make the best of these technologies will be growth stocks. So you're going to see companies that make new super insulated windows and energy management systems. There'll be interesting companies going forward. Because
you see builders who will focus in this area as well?
All builders are starting
all
to
builders,
focus on
okay.
this area. Basically, if you're building houses right now, you have to address the whole green building thing. And some will be better than others. But right now, everybody pays lip service to it.
Right.
And so it's not so much a revolution where some new group of companies and technologies has taken over.
You have to do it to stay in the game.
Yeah, it's a mass conversion. Everybody's into green building now. So, in a few years, when you want to put up your dream house, you're going to have the choice of really cool technologies to implement that'll make your house.
It sounds, John, like you're trying to make sure we don't spend any money for 3 years.
Well, a lot of this stuff you don't want to.
Yeah. I agree totally.
Yeah.
Okay, so pollution control.
Yeah. Basically, there are a lot of ways now that are coming along that allow you to take what used to be a liability, trash, and turn it into electricity or biofuel or something like that. And this is going to lessen pressure on landfills and might even turn landfills into mines where you go and you get the stuff that we dumped 10 years ago and you turn it into biofuel or burn it cleanly to generate electricity. So here again, the technology...
I don't know if you know William McDonough's expression, waste equals food.
Yes. Absolutely. In nature, nothing is wasted.
Right.
Nature just doesn't throw stuff away to let it sit for 10,000 years. It recycles everything. And we're learning to do that on a lot of different levels. And the whole waste to energy and pollution control side of things is one of the really interesting ones because we generate a lot of waste, which means we generate a lot of potential fuel or, food or whatever.
Right.
And we're learning how to recycle it.
Okay, water.
All right, water is a big one. And that's another one like smart grid that's here now. This is investable. Basically, we have built a society around the assumption of cheap energy and unlimited water. Now, we know about the energy thing, how that was a mistake. But the water assumption might even be bigger because most of the U.S. Southwest and a lot of the rest of the U.S. and a lot of the rest of the world is using all the water that's available right now and running through the aquifers where we used to pull water out of the ground and drying up the rivers. The Rio Grande River doesn't make it to the ocean a lot of years now. And so we're basically running out of water in a lot of different places, and we need to figure out what to do about that. And one way to address that is to get a lot more efficient. There are a lot of technologies that allow you to use water more efficiently and sensors that detect leaks in municipal water systems and technologies for fixing the leaks and building new systems that use water more efficiently. And this is going to be a gigantic business going forward because every city, and the older the city, the more this is true, wastes huge amounts of water. And so if you can come in with a technology that eliminates a lot of that waste, people are going to be willing to pay for that. Now, on the supply side, a lot of places just flat out, you know, even if they don't waste anything, they don't have enough water. So they've got to get more water. And something called desalination is becoming cheap enough to be a viable technology going forward. And that is basically taking seawater and turning it into fresh water. The two or three ways that it's done, all are getting cheaper, and there's still some environmental problems with a lot of these technologies, so that has to be worked out. But when it is, that'll also be a big business, because you can site these things along, say, the California coast, and turn seawater into fresh water at a price that at least people in, say, San Diego would be willing to pay.
Are there any businesses that deal with Rainman, or is that just something that individuals are doing? Just
rainwater.
Catching the rain on your roof?
None that I know of. But,
is it part of the green building?
Yeah. There are a lot of buildings now. For instance, there's one I profiled in the book in New York City that captures rainwater and uses it to flush the toilets and run the sinks on two or three floors of the building.
Right.
So that's the kind of thing that people just incorporate now into green building. And they irrigate a garden on top of the building with that water. So,
wow.
Yeah, that works, but that's not really something that is...
It's not a company function.
Yeah, it's not a technology where you can point to a growth stock that makes
rainwater
technology.
Okay, well, now my favorite, agriculture.
Yeah.
Did you see Jimmy Rogers' quote? I just got to read this. I got it up on the blog. Agriculture's been... This is Jim Rogers on CNBC the other day. Agriculture has been a horrible business for 30 years. For decades, the money shufflers, the paper shufflers, have been the captains of the universe. That is now changing. The people who produce real things will be on top. You're going to see stockbrokers driving taxis. The smart ones will learn to drive tractors because they'll be working for the farmers. It's going to be the 29-year-old farmers who have the Lamborghinis. So you should find yourself a nice farmer and hook up with him or her, because that's where the money's going to be in the next couple of decades.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I liked the world in which farmers have Lamborghinis and stuff.
Yeah, so do I.
Yeah. But
it's not very green, but...
The current agricultural system kind of ties into the whole assumption of unlimited energy and unlimited water, because we've basically built a global industrial food system where we ship things from one part of the world to another using massive amounts of energy in the process, and that's not viable anymore, probably. So we're going to have to scale back and go local to a greater extent, and there are a lot of interesting technologies that tie into this. And one of the ones that I think is very cool, and I think it ties into the whole local food thing, is vertical farming, where you take an abandoned building in the middle of a city and convert it to a hydroponic garden, but on a big scale. And that vertical farm then grows food year-round that's completely local. And, you know, at the base of it is a year-round farmer's market, basically.
Right.
And that is a nice... adjunct to the local farming community. You know, you could envision a system where vertical farms within a city grow certain things that aren't being grown by the local farmers, and vice versa. And so without having to transport food long distances, you get a nice variety of food grown locally by local people, and the money stays there, and we eat better than we do now. So
now, I also want to mention, I sent you all those Monsanto links. John, for those listening, John did a fabulous job of pointing out how nuclear was not green and clean coal was not green, but he did include Monsanto in the agriculture section, so I'm trying to persuade him to delete them in the second edition.
Yeah, you're bringing me around on that. The more I see, the original reason for including Monsanto and genetically modified foods in general was that I thought that... such things have a role to play in the future, because it's possible we can design crops that grow in places where they can't necessarily grow now, and in that way deal with the hunger problem that's coming. And,
right.
You know, a drought-tolerant crop in a place with a water shortage, that has value. But there are a lot of downsides to the way that business is run by Monsanto and others that...
Well, I'll send you some links, and I think you'll find them very persuasive. Okay, well, let's... Anyway, I wanted to just touch on a couple of other issues which come up when you look at this area, and you did a terrific job of covering them. So let's just quick run through them. The complexity is overwhelming. How do we handle that?
Well, clean tech isn't just one industry. It's not like commercial real estate or retailing or something like that, where you have a set of companies, you know what they do, and you can make choices between them. It's 10 different technologies with 20 different new technologies coming along, and it's easy to start looking at this stuff and then just get overwhelmed by the complexity of it and just give up hope. And so the solution for that is to focus on maybe one or two things at a time and get to know them. For instance, get to know Smart Grid and solar.
So get to know the ones that are here now and that you relate to.
Yeah. Or if you have some background in one or another, then that's a good place to start, too. But basically, since so many of these things aren't here now just yet, you know, they're something for 2 or 3 years in the future, you really don't need to worry about them yet. And so if you could narrow it down to the handful that are ready and have a nice selection of companies running the gamut from growth stocks to established companies, then that's a little bit easier. And you also just don't expect to understand it right away. You know, take your time and spend some time with it. Because the market is so crappy right now, we probably have another year or two, although there could be some nice rallies in between, but we have a couple of years of hard economic times in which to get to know these companies and these industries. And then when things start to pick back up and clean tech begins to lead us out of the depression, then you're ready. You know, then you can jump on board and tell the good ones from the bad ones and really put together a good portfolio. So
now, one option is to use funds, because there are funds that specialize in these areas.
Yeah, that's one way to do it. You hand it off to somebody who spends 12 hours a day looking at this stuff and has been doing that for 5 years already and has a good handle on it. And there are some good mutual funds out there that run by people who are veterans of the industry and who know what they're doing. And there are also some ETFs, exchange-traded funds, that'll just buy you a selection of big companies in a given field. And so you get exposure to the whole thing by doing it that way. So that's one way. But see, that's not a substitute for learning about this stuff yourself. If you're interested in it and someday you want to pick your own stocks, you still got to educate yourself along the way. But a mutual fund is a good way to commit some money right away without having to really dig too deeply.
When I looked at them for my circle, I came to the conclusion that we were going to do all foreign stocks, because so much of the seasoned companies were really in Europe and Asia.
Yeah, well, the U.S. Fell far behind a lot of the rest of the world in clean tech in the last decade, and because Europe had a lot stricter rules when it came to the environment, and they were a lot more generous in their subsidies of solar and wind. So that's where those industries grew up first. And a lot of the biggest companies are over there. A lot of the biggest water stocks especially are in Europe and Asia. And so that makes it kind of tricky, because a lot of these things...
One of the things you do in the book that I thought was very helpful was cover, if you want to buy foreign stocks, how do you do it? Because not just automatically, instantaneously possible through every U.S. broker.
Yeah. Most brokers are starting to add some capabilities to allow you to trade stocks.
Yeah, that's true. It's growing.
But not all of them are very good yet or very enthusiastic about it. So there are a handful that are, and I list a few that are examples of the different kinds of brokerage houses that will help you trade foreign stocks. And so it's doable now. It depends on your level of expertise, whether you want somebody who's a full-service brokerage house that'll hold your hand and explain how everything works, or if you want to go the other route with a discount broker that just gives you the platform and lets you go to it. So it's both are possible, and it's up to you what you want to do. But it is possible now for a U.S. investor to trade all of these stocks along with everything else that's out there.
Now, this is one of my favorite parts, because you do a great job on this in the books, give some great examples. If this kind of technology really takes hold and takes off, who are the stinkers who are going to get hurt? Who's going to lose? Who should we avoid?
Well, every big trend has two sides. If it encourages some industry or companies within an industry, then it must discourage others, right? It must hurt people who are on the wrong side of that trend. And let's say that water, for instance, becomes a big issue going forward because we have water shortages out there, or the price of water goes through the roof, which it'll almost certainly have to. So the companies that need tons of water and haven't made provisions for getting it at a good price are going to be hurt. And that could be Coca-Cola. You know, they have bottling plants all over the world. A lot of them are in dry places. A lot of them are in Africa and Asia, where water shortages are going to be a problem. So it's possible that as the water management companies thrive, companies like Coca-Cola will be hurt. You could short Coke and go long some of the water companies, and then you make it in both directions. And
there's a whole lot of people in this area. I love the idea of shorting successfully.
Yeah, shorting is just great, and it's hardly done. I mean, in the last 2 years...
It's great if you know how to do it. It's not so great if you don't, Sean.
Yeah. But once you figure it out, it's just addictive, because the last couple of years, I mean, shorting was the best thing to do. You could have shorted anything and made huge amounts of money.
Yeah.
Shorting Merrill Lynch and Citigroup and all those big crazy...
Can you imagine running Citigroup down to less than a dollar?
Oh, you know, I shorted Citigroup, but I bailed at 20, which is still... It was okay. I made money. But yeah, the last 6 months... all you had to do was just short anything you wanted to short.
Okay, so now tell us how we can stay current on this area and how we just get basic knowledge. We were talking earlier that I said, you know, for basic definitions, can I go to Wikipedia? And you said yes, which was thrilling.
Yeah. Well, any time you see a term you don't understand, type it into Google, and the Wikipedia entry will come up first.
Right.
And then just go there, read it, and then you've got a basic sense of what it is you're looking at. And then from there, I mean, you want to read a couple of good books that explain the subject matter.
Well, I'm going to say it again. Your book is terrific, so I think everybody should start with Clean Money.
Good. Well, yeah, that was the idea behind the book, was to give you something that you could sit down with and go through, and then you have kind of working knowledge of all this stuff. And then
you have a framework, and it's clear, and it's simple, and it makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. And then from there, then you really start digging. And you can do that with, there are a lot of websites out there. Now, this is a hot field, so there are new websites coming along all the time. And there are some good ones that are established. And
you're following it. You're going to keep following it, greenstockinvesting.com.
Yeah, exactly. The Greenstock Investing is basically the breaking news in the field. So I have a lot of news feeds, clean tech news feeds, and when an interesting story comes along, I just pop a link to it over on Greenstock Investing. So you can go there, or at least in theory, you can go there for an hour and see what has happened in the past 24 hours in the fields that you're interested in, and stay up to speed that way.
Well, before signing off, John, I really want to thank you, but I certainly want to give you an opportunity. Was there anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to tonight?
Okay. You know what? I think we've gone through it all. Let me see. No, I had notes that I had taken as we were talking before and while we were discussing all this, and I think we've covered just about everything.
Well, I can't thank you enough. This has been really terrific. It's, you know, as you listen to all the news about how dire everything, what you realize is there are so many things that we can do and that are coming.
Oh, yeah. Well, and problems lead to opportunities. So
yeah.
One way to look at all the environmental and energy problems we have is that each one of them is an opportunity for an investor to find companies that are going to benefit from all of this and make money from it.
One of the things I love about Clean Money, you start off by describing the civilizations that should have changed and didn't and literally got wiped out.
Yeah.
And it's very inspiring. You say, you know, I think we better shift our capital here pretty quickly.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of that stuff is eerily familiar, isn't it? Because a lot of past societies made mistakes that are similar to a lot of what we're doing now, except we're doing it on a vastly bigger scale.
Yeah.
You know, we're using up all our resources and polluting in ways that that past societies couldn't have dreamed of doing. And they still managed to wipe themselves out.
Well, let's not do that. Okay, John, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and we wish you the best and hope to stay in touch and in cahoots.
Great. Thanks, Catherine.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, just quickly on Let's Go to the Movies, the The movie this week is George Baker's documentary, The Endurance. It's the story of Ernest Shackleton's expedition to the to cross the Antarctica, and so cross the whole continent. And there are two points I want to make about this. If you haven't had a chance to watch it, I really recommend it. It's one of my favorite documentaries of all time. I just think it's an outstanding story. One of the things that's so interesting about it is it's a story of an expedition that failed. Shackleton and his men, there were two boats supporting the expedition, and the Endurance with Shackleton and his men got out into Antarctica, and the ice froze around them and ultimately froze the ship and then destroyed it. And the story is really about the failure and the response of the team to failure and Shackleton's success at leading his men back to safety. And there are two points I want to make about it. One is documentation. One of the reasons that this story happened was they took a camera, and despite all of the hardships and all of the sacrifices and the extraordinary effort to get home, they preserved the negatives and brought them home with them. And it's just a reminder that it is possible to maintain excellent documentation under the most severe circumstances. And I want to make a point that's a bit of the leap, but it's really, really important. If you look at anybody who's lived through tough times or through disasters, how important it is to maintain excellent documentation for a variety of reasons. If you talk to people who lived through Katrina in New Orleans, what you hear again and again is the people who had redundant, excellent documentation could prove who they were, what their assets were, what their insurance were, back up running much more quickly than the ones who couldn't. So documentation is very important. The second thing is it's really a story about a group of people who had one goal. And then that goal, they fail to achieve that goal, and then suddenly they have to become committed to a new goal. And I just want to read a section of the commentary at sort of the middle of the documentary that relates to this point. It goes, there is nothing that can crush a man as to see his dreams crumble to the dust. But on the other hand, he, meaning Shackleton, realized that if the one goal had disappeared, he had another one. And so I can't cross the continent. I'm going to bring all the men back alive. You mustn't forget that polar exploration was littered with dead bodies. This almost fanatic desire to bring his men back alive, this then became the driving force. It was the only thing he cared about. That change from aiming to attain what you had set out to extracting yourself from defeat is a strain that has broken many a man. It did not break Shackleton. And then later on they go to say, they had a pretty miserable time on the ice, but having said that, in the end, at every turn, Shackleton's enemy was not the ice, but it was his own people in the sense that their morale was the foe. He had to prevent their morale from crumbling. The ice was nothing. Anybody can deal with the ice. But to deal with a human spirit, that is very difficult. Now, why did I want you to watch this documentary? What's happening to many of us in this society is we've been going along thinking that our lives was going in a certain direction, and increasingly the change that's happening, whether it's a drop in the value of our assets or being laid off from a business or our business going under, any of the changes that are upon us, suddenly instead of being in the process of achieving whatever our dream is, we find ourselves having to literally do something different or contemplate something different. Many of us are grappling with having to move from one goal or one dream to a very radical sort of position where we have to change our goals. And when that happens, there can be real morale issues and real issues of the human spirit. It's extremely difficult. And it was extremely difficult for me in the mid-90s and late 90s to wake up and realize that we had a leadership that was literally playing the what I just described, the break-it-or-fix-it game But they weren't just playing it with my life or my company. They were playing it with the whole economy, not just in the United States, but planetary. You know, re-engineering things with an arrogance that, that is breathtaking. And I think when you come to that realization, it's a scary moment, and it's a moment of grief, and we turn on the TV or we watch the Internet every day, and we have these folks trying to persuade us that the end of the world has come. And so I think it's extremely valuable to watch this documentary and realize that, in fact, there's this kind of switch that needs to go on. You know, John Lennon said, life is what happens when you are busy making other plans. And that's a statement that's going to be very true for a lot of us during this period of change. And the key to success, because as John said, there's incredible opportunities for community, for family, for our culture, to build new worlds. There are incredible opportunities. But one of them is to literally let go of where we thought we were going and grab on to the possibilities and the positive in this, and not let the lies, and the lies are serious and they are forceful, but not let the lies get to your human spirit. And when you watch The Endurance, what you'll see is a group of people who, you know, who did that and beat all odds. It's an incredible story. So with that, let me just say I look forward to seeing you next week or talking with you next week on Thursday, March 12th. It's going to be our Precious Metal Update with Franklin Sanders. The movie will be Eyes Wide Shut, which we'll be talking about in the context of my blog series, The Data Beast. If you have not seen Eyes Wide Shut, I strongly recommend it for the purposes of this discussion. I wouldn't say it's the most entertaining movie. It's Stanley Kubrick's last. It's deeply disturbing, so pour yourself a stiff glass of orange juice before watching. And then the following week, March 19th, we're going to be talking about the nuts and bolts of organizing a Solari circle. So with that, you're in our prayers. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.